Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Popcorn Prosecco, a show that's all about talking about movies. I'm Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Christy Puchko and Angie Han.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
All right, so this week we are talking about Unbroken, The Gambler, and Into the Woods, and we're going to kick it off with Unbroken. Angie, you're taking it from here.
Yep. So Unbroken is the new movie directed by Angelina Jolie. It stars Jack O'Connell as Louis Zamperini, who was a real person. So it's yet another biopic during prestige pick season. But anyway, so Louis Zamperini, we pick up with him when he's a kid, and as a high schooler, he becomes a track star, and eventually he becomes such a good track star that he actually goes to the Olympics. So that happens. And then a little while later, he joins the army because it's World War II, and then he is flying in a plane, and the plane gets shot, or it doesn't get shot down. I guess it's broken.
It falls apart.
No, yeah, it was like a malfunction. The engines go out.
Right. The plane falls apart, so then they get dropped randomly in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and so he's on a raft with Domhnall Gleeson and Finn Wittrock for a long time, just kind of floating around Life of Pi style. Eventually, they get rescued. Yay! The bad news is the people rescuing them turn out to be Japanese soldiers who, remember, World War II, not a big fan of American soldiers. So then the rest of the movie sees him as a Japanese prisoner of war being tormented by, among other people, Miyavi. Sorry, that's the name of the actor. They call him the Bird, and he's this like sadistic person that's always eating them and being horrible. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like I didn't make it sound very interesting, and to be honest, I don't think this movie is that interesting. It's not boring. It's not like I was bored while I was watching it, but to me, it felt like such a simplistic story. It felt like there was no real depth. We never really got to understand what made Louis tick. I mean, the movie's called Unbroken, but it's not that impressive that somebody's unbroken if it never seemed like there was any real chance of them breaking.
Oh, I loved it.
Oh, really?
I was actually much more entertained than I thought I was going to be. I guess I was more more entertained than I was moved by the material, which probably isn't the right thing with this kind of movie. I think a true story, you know, you want to delve into that real person and their story, and kind of like what Angie said, you know, what makes him tick, and that way you can feel like the threat of him beginning to crack, which you don't really feel. But I mean, this is kind of a movie where, I mean, it's super long, but it would come on TV and I would probably see it in the background and then have to sit down and watch it. And I'd be like, oh, I'm looking forward to watching them try to survive in the raft. Then I'm looking forward to him trying to survive in the first camp. Then, like, what does he do in this scene? And I think I'm going to get wrapped up in it. And that is what happened during my first screening of it. I enjoyed it as like, the story that it was. But agreed, not much depth.
I agree that I was more entertained than moved, but maybe I was less entertained than you were. Like I said, I wasn't bored. Like, I was watching it. It was interesting the whole time to watch. But then at the end, I was just like, well, that happened.
To me, it feels like a reverse Hobbit, where The Hobbit is a movie that could have been one movie, but we decided to make three. And this feels like a movie that could have been three movies, but they decided to make one. And in doing that, you get a lot about this guy's life, but not about who this guy is internally. And like Angie said, like, watching the movie, I never believe he is going to crumble under his circumstances. And without that, you lose a lot of the dramatic stakes of the movie, which is a shame. For me, the second movie in it, where there's the shipwreck.
The Life of Pi movie?
The Life of Pi section was my most engaging part, but that was mostly because sharks. There are so many sharks, guys, and I'm not okay with sharks, and so I was literally, like, shouting at my screen when they would appear because it upset me. But, I mean, like, it's strange. There's parts of this movie that I think are really good, and I think Angelina Jolie, who directed it, like, does some really beautiful work with it, but I don't think she has, like, a pronounced style that makes it an interesting movie. It just feels like a very color-by-numbers biopic of, like, here is a great American man.
It really does. I mean, I know that she is, I know she has a lot of respect for him, and the movie respects him a lot, and it maybe respects him too much because it's afraid to show him as, like, anyone that's flawed. But this is one of those cases where if they had actually ever shown us, you know, that, like, that he has weak spots, that he's flawed, that he's imperfect, that he can be a bad person, then it would have been all the more triumphant to see him overcome those struggles. I know it sounds ridiculous to say, to complain that a movie about a man being brutally tormented for years in prison is, you know, doesn't have enough struggle in it, But even as we see all these things happening to him, we don't really see how it affects him that much.
Exactly. It's funny, even though I didn't enjoy Selma as much while I was watching it, talking about it like this kind of makes me realize that, you know, one of the best, I mean, we'll get to this in a future episode, but one of the best parts about Selma is that it's all these, like, really crazy things that happen to the character, but it gives you a really layered representation of Martin Luther King, where you actually really see and feel how he reacts to every little step of that process. And, you know, here, not so much. I definitely did care about Jack O'Connell in the movie. Like, when he gets to the coal section, I'm like, holy shit, how is he ever going to come out of that? So, like, it did have that kind of effect, but this is, Selma's a character piece. This is not, and it needed to be.
And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
It's especially disappointing because Jack O'Connell, like, if you've seen him in other stuff, like, I saw him in Startup this year, he's a great actor. He would have definitely risen to the challenge if Angelina Jolie had given him enough work to do. Yeah, he just feels wasted here, even though it's his biggest movie ever.
Yeah, and also, like, all he gets to do is be a tough guy. And, like, it would have been interesting to see him have a moment of doubt. I mean, like, I was talking with Angie about this the other day, actually, about how when we talked about Startup, we talked about the fact that when he's introduced in that movie, he seems like a scrawny kid, and then you see him as this, like, tiger when he gets into a fight, but then later you emotionally see him broken down, and so when he rebuilds himself in that film, it makes the film more complex and more interesting, and like Perry said with Selma, it's a portrayal of Martin Luther King Jr. that shows him as more than just this amazing man. It makes him human, and I think that that's what Unbroken is missing, is the human aspect. Like, I watch this, and I don't think, like, oh, that guy's like me. I think, like, oh, that guy is, like, way stronger at everything than I am, and I can't connect to it. You know what I mean? It just doesn't... It doesn't allow for an audience to be like, oh, I get what he's going through. And it's like, I mean, obviously most of us have not been shipwrecked and most of us haven't been POWs, but we need that small moment of, like, connection so that we can empathize. And instead of, like, watching and feeling with him, I just felt like I was watching him.
I actually think he only breaks down once in the entire movie or, like, gets visibly upset, which
and,
is
like,
kind of crazy
happens,
considering
like,
what he goes through.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of shit that happens that, like, understandably, you could lose your mind about. I mean, like, and the thing is that instead they have characters around him break down. Like, Dandy from American Horror Story Freak Show is in this, and, like, he breaks down, and, like, Donald Gleason breaks down.
Yeah, and it's actually, it's kind of disrespectful to those people, the real people, because they make it look like, because Jack O'Connell's character, because Zamperini is so strong with, like, no signs of breaking down, it makes everyone else around him look weak, even though, if you think about it, if this many horrible things happen to you in a row, like, you would probably, like, pretty much everyone in the known universe would
be a little crushed. Maybe Zamperini actually did behave this way. Maybe he never lost his cool. Maybe he was always confident or whatever. I don't care. I want an interesting movie more than I want the truth.
If that is the case and that is really how it went down, that's when you take artistic license and
exactly. You
just give something like an extra layer that might not have really been there. Because, I mean, this is a movie. It's not a documentary. They say it all the time when you make movies about true stories, and there's a reason for that because, you know, we need an entertaining story
with
layers and some sort of suspense. And it's not as suspenseful as it could have been. But again, I was very entertained.
It's not a documentary, and it shouldn't be a love letter either, and that is what it felt like it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good dad movie. I think that, you know, dads across America will be super excited about seeing this. I think if you're a big World War II fan, you'll be interested in this. It's not a bad movie. It's just not an extraordinary one.
During award season, too, and there was so much hype where, like, no one had seen it for forever, and then finally it was here. So, you know, that probably lessens the excitement more so than if the thing finally just came out and everyone saw it, and they're like, yeah. You know, and, like, it's up against, look at what it's up against this season, too. So, you know, automatically it's going to pale in comparison no matter what.
Yeah, and, like, politically it has nothing to say.
Yeah, I actually think if you're a big World War II buff, like, we weren't huge fans of Fury when that came out, but I felt a lot more moved by that movie even than this one. I don't know. I think that Jack O'Connell is talented enough that he will move on to bigger and better things. I think that Angelina Jolie, she's not bad. She just kind of feels, she's just kind of bland. But, you know, she seems like a competent director. So she's another person that I expect her next movie. I expect
like,
her to be
the action
better.
Scenes in this are very well executed. She does a really great job at building, like, pace and tension in certain moments. it's just character development as a director that I feel she failed at.
I think we should wrap up soon, but can I ask you guys one more question? Is it just me, or does the black hair just never stop looking weird on Jack O'Connell?
It never stops looking weird. It looks really fake.
Well, it doesn't bother me.
Weirdly, it looks like doll hair. Incredibly fake. Like, I don't know what the colorist was doing that day, but it definitely always looks like he is a person with, like, brown hair who dyed his hair black.
Yeah, like, as someone who dyed my hair black to try to get that edgy look, and people thought I was wearing a wig, and that's what he looks like. He looks like he's wearing a wig.
Yeah, but any last thoughts?
I highly recommend it. I mean, it's not what it should have been, it's not what it could have been, but that doesn't stop it from being entertaining.
I would say with that caveat, yeah, like, I think if you watch these trailers and are like, that looks fascinating, like, yeah, it is fascinating. Just kind of go in knowing that, like, you're going to have to meet the character more than halfway.
Yeah, I'm with you guys. You know, it's entertaining. If it looks like you're a cup of tea, then go for it. But if you're going in expecting, like, a profound character study, you know, you're going to be disappointed.
You know what? One more thought. It almost felt like that, and now I'm going to feel really bad saying this because it's a true story. It almost felt like a disaster movie to me. You know, when it's just about, like, watching these characters go through this crazy situation and not necessarily about who the people are, but it's like that kind of fun.
Yeah, that's actually very true. Where it's way more about, like, and then this shitty thing happened.
Yeah.
Completely. All right, see
so
that.
We're going to move on to the next one now, which is The Gambler.
A different kind of disaster movie.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
You
ended
there.
Ba-dum-boom. There's the full quote. All right, so The Gambler stars Mark Wahlberg as Jim Bennett, and by day he is a college English professor, and by night he is a gambler, and we meet him when he goes into, like, this pop-up gambling casino inside this mansion, and he is just throwing down, like, a crazy amount of chips, like, shit ton of money. He gets up really high, and then he just blows it all because he is a gambling addict, and, like, I guess a gambling addict to his level would do. He goes and he borrows money from, like, the worst people in the world. He loses it. He does it again. And, all right, I pretty much explained the movie. He gambles. He wins a lot of money. He loses it all. And then he goes and he does it again and again and again and again. And, like, there's this little, like, romantic bit with Brie Larson's character, who's one of his students, who just so happens to be working in that pop-up casino for no reason at all, which didn't make any sense. And they
also
got
for no reason at all is attracted to him.
Yeah, you know what's funny?
He's, like, scrawny looking, he has hair that looks like a bad wig, and he just says douchebag stuff the entire movie.
Like an asshole for doing this, but during my interview with her for The Gambler, I said it. I'm like, is it hard to connect with a character who is so infatuated by a guy who's so damn self-destructive? And she kind of went like, well, don't we all get like that every once in a while? It's just being human. And I'm like,
she can't very well say, well, the script was pretty shitty, so I guess.
She's never going to be like, well, I needed the money, even if it's true, which I'm not saying it is. I don't know why she did it, but yeah.
I don't know.
That's a waste of Brie Larson. Like, it's really just her looking, like, shy in one scene and then being flirtatious
and, like,
in
looking
scene,
super studious, too, with her glasses.
Yeah. I have glasses, because student. Like, it's... It's such a waste of her.
How disheartening was Mark Wahlberg's speeches in that class, too? That basically, if you're not a genius at something, just give up on life, because there's no point in you trying. Go be a plumber or an electrician.
Yeah, he's teaching a literature class, which also, like, I don't know about you guys, but I had literature classes in college with no expectation that I was going to be a writer. It was just like, let's study the great American novel. Period.
The whole teacher thing is weird because, one, he's always yelling at his students for not learning, but two, he never teaches them anything. He doesn't even talk about books. He's like, today we read Hamlet. Anyway, let me go on a rant about how unless you're the greatest writer that ever lived, you should just kill yourself.
You know, this was another question that I had asked during one of my interviews that I got kind of like a non-answer to, is like, what was Jim up to before we meet him in this movie? Was there ever a point where he was a successful writer and he believed in himself? Because, I mean, otherwise nothing that happens in this movie is justified at all, because if that's the way he behaves in that class all the time, there's no way he's going to have a job. There has to be some sort of, like, point where, you know, things changed and he kind of got totally disheartened and started, like, shitting all over everyone.
Yeah, and they never introduced that, and there's, like, a lot of stuff that's set up and never paid off. Like, he mentions how his dad's missing, and he blames his mom, but they never go into, like, why or what the hell happened there. And it's just really it's a very bizarre script, and it's written by the guy who did The Departed, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, like, I don't know. And it's a remake, so I didn't see the original. I
saw the original.
I just read the original. Oh, well, Angie would know better than me, but I read the original on Wikipedia, and I don't think they're similar, right?
Wait, what did you say, Christy?
Did the original make any sense?
It makes more sense than this one. It's actually, it's pretty different in terms of tone. The ending is very different. It's a, you know,
it's a remake, but
I will give them credit for taking a completely different angle on the same premise.
Okay. What's weird is that the ending thinks it's a celebration. And I did not feel like it was.
And well, I think we should save spoilers for the end of the segment, but yeah, I do want to talk about that ending. Overall, I just kind of felt like, I was like, I can see the movie, I can maybe at some point see the movie that Rupert Wyatt thought he was making. Like, I don't have anything against the hero who's very unlikable or, you know, or a complete asshole. But it wasn't interesting.
Well,
I felt like the movie was so, like, muddled about, like, whether it wanted us to think that this person was a hero or a horrible person. I don't know.
I mean, admittedly, I tend to not like unlikable characters. Like, that's probably why I have a lot of issues with Coen Brothers movies. But this wasn't just about him being an unlikable character. It was being repetitive. I mean, he just did the same thing over and over, and, you know, I mean, again, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but obviously, you know, something happens, but, like, nothing sparks the change
that
we can see.
No. And, like,
there's really no arc to his journey at all. He does the same thing over and over, and then it's like, oh, time to wrap it up. We got to put a nice little bow on it.
And I actually want to warn people that watched the trailer and thought, oh, that looks pretty crazy and great. It's not. Because the trailer's great. Like, I watched the trailers like, that's going to be bonkers and fun and John Goodman. But, like, John Goodman is in the movie for maybe 7 minutes.
And he's most good for all 7 minutes of it, though.
John Goodman's great, but he's a super minor, like, super minor character.
You know who else is great? I really liked Michael K. Williams. Because, that, you know, right there, that's it. That's the most fascinating part of this movie, is the dynamic between his character, Neville, and who is one of the guys that Mark Wahlberg borrows money for, and Jim. Because they play this really, like, fascinating game between, like, him being the one who needs his money back, so, like, wanting to kick his ass. But then at the same time, all of a sudden he turns around and it's like they could be friends. So it's really fun to track that relationship and try to figure out when Michael K. Williams is going to snap.
Yeah, I think it's all on Williams. I think he's a great actor and he is interesting. And this movie proves that he could act against a wall.
Like, yes. But
like, literally cut to paint drying and cut back to Michael Williams and I'll watch that scene.
Yeah, but I do, again, I just don't think the script does his character justice, because here's one thing, all of the gangsters that keep lending Mark Wahlberg money have seen that he's terrible with money and never pays anyone back, but
and
they keep giving him money, and I'm like, how are you a successful gangster if you just give away money to idiots all the time?
That's another problem with the lack of backstory for Mark Wahlberg's character, is that, you know, we don't really see what his reputation is within that community prior to right where the movie starts. So,
yeah.
I mean, for all we know, he could have been meeting these people for the first time.
Yeah. It's a strange place to start the movie. It's a very bizarre place to end the movie.
I just thought it was really boring.
I'm convinced that, like, a month from now I won't remember having seen this movie.
I want to say one other thing. So Mark Wahlberg is incredibly self-destructive. It's clear that he has, like, almost like a death wish in this movie. And he's just so unhappy with how his life has turned out, and, you know. But the thing is, he is an incredibly wealthy, well-educated, smart, you know, other than the gambling thing, professionally successful, straight white man living in America. I don't know. To me, that was kind of obnoxious. I mean, I'm not saying that, oh, white men don't have problems. Obviously, they do. And obviously, I've watched lots of movies about white men with problems and sympathize with them. But in this movie, it's just that he has so much more privilege than anyone else. And they keep
pointing it out, too. They shove it down your throat that really the only problems in his life are self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I do understand, like, you know, I would watch a movie about a guy that had self-inflicted problems. Like, that's one of the things that I find enjoyable about Mad Men, which is a show I really like. But in this case, it's just, it's exhausting, it's infuriating, it gets tedious after, like, the eighth time he blows up his own life because no reason.
And it's not all that exciting either.
No, I mean, gangsters keep threatening to kill him, and you're like, can you just please? Because this movie is just tiresome.
And that's all it is like gangsters threatening to kill him and punching him, or just watching him do the same exact motions on a blackjack table. And that's it. And that just does not, it can't be compelling the fourth time over. You know who I did also like in this movie, though? Jessica Lange. Because there wasn't much, I don't think there was much to the mother
character. Again, she's in it for maybe 5 minutes.
She's in it for maybe 5 minutes, but I feel like that second scene with her when he wants the money, I don't know, like, I really just sided with her, and I felt for her, and she was barely in it. We don't really know much about, too much at least, about their relationship, but I felt bad for his mother.
I did too, especially because people keep threatening that, like, they're like, oh, well, clearly you don't give a shit about your life. Well, if you don't pay me back, what if I murder everyone in your family? And he's like, whatevs.
You know what else is really annoying? That he eats cereal the entire movie. Like, stop eating cereal.
Really? Of all the things to be on this movie, him eating cereal?
It was such
cereal?
A weird thing to be doing during some
not
of the
really.
Most
I
conversations.
Can I say that I don't buy him as an English professor? Like, we're like, oh, well, Mark Wahlberg, English professor.
I might have bought it in a different movie, but this one doesn't try hard enough to sell it, because as I mentioned, he's a horrible English professor that doesn't seem to have ever read a book in his life.
Wasn't
so
he a teacher in The Happening, too? Maybe he just shouldn't play teachers.
I don't know. So what did you guys think of the ending?
The ending is it's
completely unearned, and there's a sign in the end of the movie, and I'm just like really? Really? Come
sign.
On. That's
what sign? What are you talking about?
Go ahead and say it. I don't think it'd be...
Oh, the...
Well, we're in spoilers now.
The lock sign... Hmm? Where he like has to run like 5 billion. He runs like all through the night and then has to pass a vacant lot sign, which is like signaling a fresh start for him.
Oh,
I mean it's just so freaking on the nose, and the camera sat on it for like 5 to 10 seconds. It was so unnecessary.
Yeah, we're like, no, we get it, Wyatt, we get it.
So, Christy, am I seeing things, or did you just do the jerk off motion when you were trying to talk about this movie?
That was that's the ending. It's fun for, I'm guessing, Mark Wahlberg and Rupert Wyatt. I don't know who this movie's for. And it's like, it was funny because like when I went home for Thanksgiving, people were asking me about this movie. And they were like, I really like that John Goodman. And like, I'm going to have to tell them, like, don't see this movie. John Goodman is in much better movies. Just watch the trailer.
Wait until someone on YouTube just like takes out all the John Goodman scenes.
Because John Goodman is fun as a gangster in this. And he's like, he's great and scary. And, you know, he has a really great speech about fuck you money that I feel like drama students will be using for the next several decades, and that's fine. That's all good stuff.
It's a good speech. It's also like...
Did you realize that the villains were color-coded?
What do you mean? Because there's a white guy, a black guy, and an Asian guy?
No, because John Goodman always wears red, the Asian guy always wears green, and Michael K. Williams always wears, I think it's black? Or like, he's got like, maybe it was black. I don't know.
This really helps. You meant that kind of color.
It makes it a little better. Like, at least now you can like pay attention to that while you're really bored watching everything else.
Just don't watch this. That's what I'm saying. To wrap up, I say don't watch it. What do you guys say?
All right, I'm with you.
Nah.
We hope we've saved you at least $8.
All right, now on to the last one. Into the Woods. Christy,
Into the Woods.
It's all yours.
No. All right, so I'm introducing Into the Woods because I'm the only one.
You have to do the whole plot summary in, like, singing it. You can't just say it, you have to sing it.
Do it.
Sorry, everyone, here we go. Into the woods, it's about a witch who's really pissed at her neighbors next door, and so she tells them that they have to go on a quest so they can have a baby. The quest, they run into Rapunzel and Cinderella and some princes and some Jack and not Jill, the Red Riding Hood, and Johnny Depp's a terrible wolf. What the fuck?
I can't believe you actually did it. But like, you kind of can, I guess.
Oh, it wasn't good, but I tried, guys. So anyway, Into the Woods is it's based on a Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine Broadway musical where it takes all these fairy tales and mashes them together. But one thing you should know, in case you didn't, is that the Broadway musical is not for children. There are some very dark themes. There is sex. There is death. There is terrible things in this movie. It makes it fun and interesting. When Disney bought the rights to Into the Woods, many of us were going, okay. And I would say that this is exactly what you would imagine from Disney's version of Into the Woods. Like, if you looked at the casting of Red Riding Hood and went, oh, instead of casting someone who looks like a teenager, they cast, like, a legit 10-year-old, they're probably going to cut the sexual implications of her subplot. Bingo. If you thought, oh, it's a Disney movie, so they might cut the sexual things that go on later in the third act, you're right. Same thing with Body Count. There's a lot of things in this movie that they pull back on and they pull their punches, and in my estimation, it makes the movie weaker because, one, it makes some plot points completely unclear, and two, the theme of Into the Woods is be careful what you wish for, because if you're going to wish for something, I don't know if you guys can hear that, my doorbell's ringing, sorry about that. Anyway.
I saw Zach's shadow cross the frame.
Hi, no, Zach. My home is haunted. No, anyway, but I mean, like, if you're gonna lay down this idea that actions have consequences, then show us the consequences. And Disney doesn't want to do that because they wanted this to be a big flashy, you know, like they took the director from Chicago and who also did Pirates of the Caribbean movies and was like, oh, and we're gonna combine his skill for musicals and his ability to do family fare and make this big holiday movie. And like, it is that. It's just frustrating because it could have been so much more interesting.
As someone who has no attachment to the source material whatsoever, I didn't care that certain things were missing. I still had fun with it for what it was, but at the same time, I can see what they took out if I look for it hard enough. It's like, you know, a certain something happens to a couple characters towards the end of the movie where there's big changes, and it's like beats are missing.
It feels like a cut, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I also, like Perry, I wasn't familiar with the musical, but going in, like, I had heard vaguely about some of the plot points, but for the most part I went in blind, and I had so much fun with, like, the first two-thirds of this movie. Like, I loved it. I was like, this is so exciting and funny and, like, way more clever than I'd expected. And then we get to the third act, and all that stuff Christy said about how Disney went and Disney-fied it, that makes the third act make no fucking sense.
It doesn't end where it should have ended.
No,
there's a very clear good ending in there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's how the dark turn in the third act, and because Disney has sold it as something so upbeat and sunny, it just doesn't make any sense.
Christy, what do you think as, like, someone who liked the original show, what would you have done if they had just cut the third act entirely? Because, like, from my perspective, I think I would have been fine if it ended right there.
I think I would have been pretty upset.
Yeah, right.
Because it kills the lesson of the movie. You would completely change the meaning of the movie if you cut what really is the movie's fine. That's fair. But I mean, I totally get what you're doing. I mean, like, the thing is, in the play, they set up that false ending, and then basically, you know, literally and metaphorically, the other foot falls. And, you know, in the movie, they don't want to deal with that. But they try to in a kind of half-assed way. And I do agree with Angie. I think that the first hour or so of this movie is very fun. And I think that if you're going to take kids to it, they will largely have a really good time. I think if you're a fan of the musical, you should lower your expectations a little.
I think if you're going to take kids to it, you should probably just leave after that, after the part,
you'll know the part
that comes two-thirds of the way through, the false ending that we've been talking about. I think that for the movie they made, it actually would have made more sense on a lot of levels to end it there. But I can completely see why, you know, it's a more interesting story if it doesn't end there and it keeps going to the real ending, but Disney botches it so badly that I think that for the movie that Disney ended up making, it makes more sense to just leave it there.
You want to talk about the performances?
Yes, I want to talk about Chris Pine.
Oh my god.
I know we might wait, but no, let's dig in. Guys, Chris Pine is the best part of this movie.
Oh my god. Yeah, no, we've talked on the show before about how I was not a Chris Pine fan, but that is rapidly changing. He is honestly so good in this movie. He has a much better singing voice than you would have thought, and he's so good as, like, this, like, goofy, incredibly vain prince. Actually, on the other hand, Meryl Streep, I thought, was, like, she was doing her Meryl Streep thing, but it was kind of not as interesting to me.
I think she's great in this, but I think it's like you expect Meryl Streep to be great, and I think she kills it. I think she does a great job as the witch. She has a lot of fun with it, and I enjoyed her. She keeps popping up and yelling at people, like, literally, like, apparating and yelling at people, and that amused me every time. But yeah, Chris Pine has a song number which is called Agony, and it's a song with him and Rapunzel's prince, who's played by Broadway star Billy Magnuson, I believe. And they're singing about how their lives are so hard because they're not with their princesses. And it's this totally overwrought, grandiose song number.
Hands down, the best scene in the entire film.
It is.
Yeah, it's a scene where...
It's like, yeah, it's the most unique staging. It's the one that takes advantage of the fact that it is a movie where they could do whatever they want with the staging, and they stage it in a waterfall, which is hilarious.
They stage it in a waterfall, and the great thing about that song is, you know, so it's about these princes pining for their princesses, and you think that it'd be sweet, but like they're always just like tearing off the shirt. Like they never
competitive never shirt tearing.
Yeah,
I do like the message of Cinderella's character though.
Yeah.
I just really appreciated that decision that she has to make.
Yeah, there's some really good, like, Anna Kendrick is fine in this. I think Emily...
And how his character reacts to it, too. I like that as well. Because that is very thoughtful.
Yeah, I think Rob Marshall found some really beautiful character moments and kept them. But it was interesting because a friend of mine who had seen the movie and had never seen the musical points out quite rightly that because it's a movie, there are things we could have seen that the movie still chooses not to show us. For instance, Cinderella keeps going to the ball. We never see the ball. And in the musical, you never see the ball. So honestly, I didn't think of it. But why don't we see the ball?
Yeah, it felt absurd. And then on a similar note, the third act of the movie takes place all in one place. Mm-hmm. And it gets very stifling. And it's the kind of decision that, I guess, makes sense if you think of how it's actually from the stage. But
and
when you're watching it in a movie...
The theater audience, yeah.
Sorry?
Like, the expectations of an audience going to see a play, they're going to be fine if you keep in the same location because they understand the parameters. But in a movie, you...
It feels weirdly static... It starts to feel stifling because then you're just stuck in this one set and you can never leave.
I think some of that material is also shot in a funny way.
Yeah.
I mean, can I say, like, the extra character in that? Or is that a spoiler?
The extra character in
like,
that.
Like, the person that's introduced in the third act?
Then they show the giant in the trailer.
Yeah, oh, okay. Well, I don't know. It's something about, like, the shots from the giant's perspective looking down on them, and it makes, like, the set seem smaller.
Yeah.
I think that was a big problem. And also the geography, too. Like, when they split up, I wasn't quite sure where everybody was. So yeah, it was just, like, hard to care. I'd be remiss
if we don't talk about Johnny Depp.
He's totally forgettable. I mean, before we talk about, I don't even think about him in this movie.
I do want to say that the girl, Little Red Riding Hood, I know you said that she's actually miscast for what the original is supposed to be like, but I thought she was incredibly good.
Well,
her,
I don't like
her and Daniel Huddleston. I think have some of the best voices, and they're just so
dynamic
in this film.
She's
they're
really
incredible.
Funny. I actually never liked Red Riding Hood when I saw the stage show version because she's such a little bitch. But, like, in this version, because I think she's a little younger and because the girl that plays her, Lily something, is it Lily?
Lilla Crawford.
Yeah.
She's quite delightful in it. And I actually thought she was, I mean, she's still really sassy and kind of mean, but I thought she was great in it. But yeah, like, Johnny Depp, he isn't in a huge section of it, which people who know the show won't be surprised by. But he is still distracting to me. Like, he puts my teeth on end because that character, just the way they've designed it and the way he plays it feels like it is from a completely different movie.
It does because he doesn't feel like a wolf. He doesn't feel like a person. It's a strange choice. And again, I think maybe something that makes more sense on the stage where it's not as weird to see a person dressed like a wolf. But he doesn't look like a wolf. He looks like a douchebag dressed as a wolf for Halloween.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't really take note of that. I didn't find him distracting, but I didn't find him memorable at all. It's like he was just kind of like a means to an end for Red Riding Hood, and that was it. And, I mean, every single time I've spoken about this movie to everybody, like, I'm just realizing this now even. Like, his name hasn't even popped into my mind once.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really great performances in it. His is, it's Johnny Depp doing Johnny Depp shit.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
That's for sure.
Would you guys recommend this Christmas?
I recommend it. I think this is a great movie to, I mean, just go and have some fun with your family kind of thing. I mean, obviously, there's a certain age range, maybe. I'd say it's for teens and up, though. But, you know, if you're looking to, like, have a good laugh, hear some pretty good songs, I mean, this is a good option.
I would recommend it. I mean, you've heard my complaints about the third act of the movie, but even with that, it's still the stuff I enjoyed about it outweighs the stuff that I didn't enjoy about it.
I would recommend it, but I would tell you that if you are a fan of the show, manage your expectations. It's not the show that you might be expecting unless you really consider what Disney does to it. But yeah, it's fun, and it's relatively harmless, and it's way better than Annie, so... Mm-hmm.
All right, that's something.
Considering how we ripped into Annie, I don't know how complimentary that sounds, but I mean, I gave it 3 stars on CinemaBlend, so there's that.
To think, I was disappointed I didn't see Annie. Oh well. All right, so that is a wrap on episode 46 of Popcorn and Prosecco. This is a letter opener, by the way. I should probably have explained that before I
You're just casually threatening us.
It's like I'm in a new place.
This is what happens when you guys aren't around.
There's stuff everywhere, and I must touch everything. All right, but we're done for this episode, and you can catch us all over the place. We have our own website, popcornprosecco.com. We are on Twitter at popcornprosecco. We have our Facebook page where we love for you to like us. And then you can also catch us on iTunes, where it would be greatly appreciated if you could rate us and also comment. We love to hear your thoughts about the show. And then you can catch all three of us all over the internet as well. Chris, do you want to take it first?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Kristy Puchko, KristyPuchko. And you can find highlights of my work at decadentcriminals.com. You should definitely check it out because I have tons of Christmas stuff up right now.
And Angie?
You can find me on Twitter at AJHAN, and I write for slashfilm.com.
And you can catch me on Twitter at PNemroff, and I write for collider.com. So thank you guys so much for watching, and we'll see you next time.
Happy holidays, everybody. You stabbed. I said happy holidays, and you stabbed your camera.
Wonderful.
Maybe.
All will come to a happy end.
Not always.